Blog Talk Radio.
This town deserves a better class of people. I'm going to give it to them.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to legendary comic book artist and illustrator Jerry Robinson, subject of a new career retrospective and biography by N.C. Christopher Couch, Jerry Robinson, Ambassador of Comics. Stick around.
Hey, did you know that you can listen to the latest Mr. Media show right on your phone with the Stitcher app? Stitcher's smart radio for your smartphone. Mr. Media is on demand and on the go with Stitcher. Download Stitcher for your phone today. Get the free app at www.stitcher.com. That's STITCHER.com.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 600 archived celebrity interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by ThePartyAuthority.us. Planning a wedding, mitzvah, or corporate event in the New York, New Jersey, or Pennsylvania area? For any and all occasions, call The Party Authority nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJs. That's 1-800-342-5357, where one call does it all. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of cackling hyenas in white face and bright red Maybelline lipstick right here in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Starting tonight, people will die. I'm a man of my word.
Oh, that Heath Ledger. For many years, Jerry Robinson was one of the forgotten men in comics. Little known outside the industry for all the years he toiled in obscurity, drawing and creating Batman comic books under the byline of the character's creator, Bob Kane, Robinson emerged from the shadows to become a celebrated and recognized talent in his own right. He's perhaps best known now as the actual creator of the greatest supervillain ever, the Joker, and Batman's cheery sidekick, Robin the Boy Wonder. But unlike many men who spent their entire careers producing the comics, Robinson's work branched out over time to fine illustration. He did commercial work on Broadway, for example, as well as contributing to books and magazines, and he did his own comic strips. One of the surprising things we learn about Robinson is his compassion for fellow artists here in the United States and around the world, many of whom struggle against much greater political issues than whether a superhero's cape should be red or blue. Along the way, he developed a point of view of a world larger and more real than is found in the studios and minds of many American artists. He and Neil Adams, for example, banged the drum loudest in the mid-1970s for Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster to be fairly compensating for creating Superman back in 1938. That led Robinson to support a number of artists struggling around the world, including Uruguay's imprisoned editorial cartoonist Francisco Lorenzo Pong. Robinson is today the subject of a new book by N.C. Christopher Couch, Chris, as most of us know him, that looks at the entire scope of Jerry's career and reproduces a wide array of his life's work. Jerry Robinson, Ambassador of Comics, also features an introduction by hard-boiled journalist and lifelong comics fan Pete Hamill, as well as a foreword by the guiding hand behind much of the modern Batman stories, Dennis O'Neill. This is my second formal interview with Jerry. I also spoke to him several years ago for my biography, Will Eisner, A Spirited Life. He and Eisner were longtime contemporaries and members of a mutual appreciation society. Eisner and Bob Kane, if you didn't know it, grew up together, went to high school together, frequently double dated, and were quite competitive with the young ladies back in the mid-30s. Jerry Robinson, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hello.
Hey, Jerry, how are you?
Yeah, okay, Bob, fine. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. Hey, congratulations on the book. Nice achievement.
Thank you very much. Yeah, Abrams did a beautiful production job and very careful care of high-resolution images of all my work. So it's very satisfying.
They do good works. Tell folks a little bit about the subtitle of the book, Ambassador of Comics.
Well, that was the publisher's title. It's very flattering. I don't know if I'm entirely Bachelor of Comics, but I guess it's based on my travels, some 45 countries, and bringing exhibitions of American cartoon art to such disparate places as Russia and Moscow and China and Japan, South America, and all over Europe. So I've started the Cartoonist and Writers Syndicate in 1978, where we represent the leading cartoonists from around the world in each country. And my idea was to have them known outside of their own country, and they were never published in the United States before. So that's been a big goal of mine, international cartooning. So I guess that's how they came to that particular name.
Let me be the, if you don't mind, the Joker's advocate in this for a second. Why do, why would an American audience be interested in the views of editorial cartoonists
mm-hmm.
from around the world?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's an excellent question, because that was what I was first asked by when I first published the work. I did a book called The Best Cartoons of the Decade, which ran from, which was the 70s, actually. And the publisher, McGraw-Hill, said they were afraid they wouldn't be able to sell the book because it contained work of foreign cartoonists who weren't known here. So my argument was that they're not known here because they haven't been published. But I knew that they were the work of great artists and great graphic artists and astute politicians in their own right. So I finally convinced them to that I wouldn't do the book unless it contained half foreign cartoonists and half American. So they did this with much trepidation, but they published it, and lo and behold, it was wonderfully reviewed, and most of the reviewers said how interesting it was to see this work from around the world that they had never had a chance to see before, and too bad they weren't published more often. So that settled the matter in my mind that this was the right time with the right product, that the world was getting smaller. I thought it was very important for American readers to see what the political opinion was that they were reading abroad. And I just had to find a format for it, because they wouldn't publish the work of any one cartoonist, because the readers would say, why print the word of work of Plantu, for example, who appeared on the front page of Le Monde every day in Paris. But if I could put together a roundup of cartoonists showing different points of view from different countries each week, that would be viable, and that would be a great service to the readers. So that's what I set out to do, and it took me a couple of years to put together the cartoonists that I already known from abroad and add others and settle on the format, send out the promo of announcing the new feature and what it looked like. And that took a couple of years, and then you sit back and wait for the reviews, just like a Broadway play.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, the papers responded. The next day, I got a call from the L.A. Times. They wanted to subscribe right away. I knew we had were onto something. And so from there on, we grew from about 20 artists to begin with in 20 countries. Now we represent over 350 artists in some 50 countries. And that's distributed every day and every week on our website and to our subscribers. If you'd like to take a look at them, you can see it at nytimages.com.
Hmm. And, Jerry, did you approach this as an art project or a political project?
Well, it was really my interest in political cartooning. At that time, I was a political cartoonist myself. Actually, most of my career has been as a political cartoonist. I did a daily political social satire for 32 years, one every day, 6 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my career has been involved with political cartooning, so particularly at that time in the 70s.
And, you know, do editorial cartoonists around the world approach their craft the same way that the Americans do in terms of American cartoonists? And I've had, for example, Clay Bennett, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist,
mm-hmm.
on the show. His, you know, with him, it's always about tweaking the establishment. You know, it's usually one side or another, but tweaking the hypocrisy and that type of thing.
Yeah.
Is it the same around the world?
No, not really. I think a lot of the countries and areas have their own traditions. Our tradition mostly has been visual in the political cartoon. I think only in more recent years has dialogue or additional written material been incorporated in the cartoon. In Europe, they've been, the countries are so intertwined, and to have multiple languages is much more common. So they do use more, integrate more dialogue in their cartoons than we normally have in political cartoons. They're also, I think, for the most part, more pro-cartoon. In other words, they're extolling some virtue. And, of course, some of it came from the countries with censorship. Obviously, they had to restrain their comments and be more in line with the ruling class in that country. Whereas here, it's mostly been less polemical and more in seeking out flaws in a policy.
Now, you say
some cartoonists say that if they don't create an enemy every day somewhere, why, they're not doing their job.
Now, Jerry, I have to ask you, you said it's less polemical here, but I'm thinking that in the days, weeks, months, even years after 9/11, that a lot of political cartoonists felt pressure not to criticize the ruling class and the way things were.
Well, that was in a period of euphoria and a tragedy when we're all pulling together, and I don't think that's indicative of the average political cartoon.
Has the pendulum swung back on that? Do you think?
Well,
that...
certainly it has. I mean, you can see the nature of the political campaigns themselves have become more and more vicious, more and more attack mode, attack ads, negative ads, and that's so. Most papers now have their own political view, and most of the political cartoonists, except for the very top ones, conform to their paper's political editorial policy. But on the other hand, many of the cartoons find their niche and with the papers that they mostly agree with, and that's basically how the work is sifted out between the cartoonists and the paper.
I just want to ask you one more
thing.
About,
I might
about
add
this.
One thing.
Yeah.
You know, the editorial cartoon is really like a column. You know, you sign, the cartoonists are signing that cartoon, so it represents their view, and the cartoonists are very jealous of that prerogative, and so it is like a visual column reflecting the view of that artist, just as the editorial writer might write the editorial cartoon for that paper. He might have some of his own views and inject them, but they don't necessarily have to conform 100% with the paper.
Well, I wanted to ask you one more thing about that, and then we'll take a quick break and come back and talk about the thing for which you're best known, the Batman, the Joker. But there came a point in the 70s where Jules Pfeiffer sought your help and told you about the case of Francisco Lorenzo Pons.
Yes.
Did you ever hesitate, even momentarily, to stick your, I was going to say toe, into such a volatile part of it, more like sticking your neck out in some way?
Neck was more appropriate. No, I didn't. I have been working for human rights a long time. I was commissioned by the UN to produce a show on human rights for the biggest conference on human rights ever held in Vienna about 1993, I believe. And And before that, I did other exhibitions with you and on the environment and others. So when Jules told me about that, I was just in the position of doing something. That year I was president of the National Cartoonist Society. And I thought, you know, there he was thrown in jail for opposing the regime. This was in Uruguay in the 70s, the worst political fascist regime in South America at the time. So I spoke to him. And after Jules briefed me on the case, I spoke to Amnesty. They assured me he was not a bomb thrower. He didn't kill anyone. He opposed their regime in Uruguay at the time, just with his pen and his writing and his drawing. So I thought, you know, there, but for the grace of God, could be one of American cartoonists who you know, that could have happened to them in their country. So I felt it was something we should try to help. And so I called all my board members around the country in the various cities where they were and to sign this joint declaration of our support for him. And we were in contact with the representatives of Lorenzo. And they told us in condition he was actually jailed and tortured terribly. You know, in those regimes, it's... you can be a murderer and be treated better than somebody who is opposing their regime, you know, physically. And so terribly tortured. We held some fundraising, and we, through some devious channels, we got money to his family. He had a small child, and they became nun persons once the head of the family was in jail for political reasons. And then we set aside to get articles about him, planted in the papers. I met with the Washington Post, the New York Times. I called artists abroad that I knew, both in South America and in Europe. They printed articles. So it was a long campaign, and finally met at the White House. I was aided in that, by the way, by my successor, president. I was also president of the editorial cartoonists. And I must say now that they were one of the chief supporters. I think I might have misspoke and said president at the time of the National Cartoonist Society. It was the Association of Editorial Cartoonists. And my successor as president was Sandy Campbell of the Nashville, Tennessee. And so the effort spanned both of our terms. And Sandy and I went to the White House. We met with Meese right next to the president's office. We met with the human rights, his title was officer in charge of human rights in the State Department, which was Abrams, who later went to jail in the scandal. And none of those places helped, by the way. They did just the opposite. So happened I knew Senator Tsongas at the time, who unfortunately since passed on, of Massachusetts, a very fine liberal senator. And he took up the cause right away. And just by the serendipity, my son was just on the summer off from law school. He was going to Northwestern and got a job at Senator Tsongas as an intern for that summer. And Tsongas called him in the office, not knowing he was my son, just to get to take this statement that he wrote out protesting that imprisonment of Lorenzo around to other senators to sign that same proclamation, which he did, and we got bipartisan support. I remember at the time Senator Baker, a leading Republican senator, Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, and so many others. I think we had about 20 signatories to that petition to free him. And to cut a long story short, it finally resulted in our meeting at the Ukrainian ambassador, Sandy Campbell, and myself, and they agreed to release Lorenzo's wife for 1 week to come up to a convention that we were holding. And I had made up a phony award just to get him out hopefully to get him out to receive it, this most distinguished foreign cartoonist award. Well, they never let they would never let him out of the country. They knew he'd come back, and they never actually let the family out because figuring they'd never come back. But they did in Lorenzo's case. His wife came up to receive the award on his behalf. So we didn't succeed in getting him out, but we did get his wife out for her. But she went back. She wouldn't leave the country without her husband. But she and her son did come up for a week. But after that, they stopped torturing him. They knew the main thing in helping these prisoners is to let them know that the world knows about them, that there's people outside who are working to free them, that they have some hope. When they give up hope, their health deteriorates, they die, or they'll commit suicide.
Mm. Well, Jerry, it almost seems mundane to switch from political freedom and torture to the Batman, but I know a lot of people tuning in will want to know about this. Can you briefly recount how you met Bob Kane and came to be the artist on Batman just 2 months into its run?
Yeah, well, again, I guess so much of my life has been serendipitous because I was 17, I graduated high school and sold ice cream on a bicycle with pulling a cart behind me that summer to earn enough money for my first semester of college. And by the end of the summer, near the end, my mother was afraid I wouldn't survive because I was on a 98-pound track team, I think, after selling ice cream all summer, pulling the cart and a bicycle. I was down to about 78 pounds. So she persuaded me to take $25, my hard-earned money, and go up in the country to fatten up. She didn't think I'd survive the first semester in college, which I did. And the first day out, I was on the tennis team in high school. Tennis is my lifelong passion. And I ran out, and I wore a jacket that we in high school used as was kind of the fad at the time. It was a college fad. I was born in Trenton, New Jersey, near Princeton, and I knew all the college kids, and that's where I think we got the idea of wearing these painter's jackets that were decorated with our own graffiti at the time. So I decorated mine with cartoons. I did draw cartoons for the school papers, cartoonist and as an editor. And so I wore this jacket out as a warm-up jacket to the tennis court. And I was looking for a partner that very first day, and I feel a tap on my shoulder. I barely turned around and saying, "Who did those cartoons on your jacket?" And I thought I was going to be arrested or so. And he said, "No, they're pretty good." And he introduced himself as Bob Kane. He had just finished Batman, the first issue, and was likewise taking a vacation. So how we met up at that, he didn't play tennis. He just happened to be walking by the court and spotted my jacket with cartoons. If I had come out an hour later or came a day later or whatever, that probably would never have happened. So he offered me a job immediately. He said, "I just started this feature. We need help on the feature." There was just the writer, Bill Finger, and himself. And I had been fortunately accepted in three colleges. I intended to be a journalist and a writer, which I have been able to do the rest of my career as well. But at that time, I had no idea of being an artist, a commercial artist, or a professional artist. And so I was accepted in Columbia, Syracuse, and Penn. And for some reason, for no good reason other than it sounded more like a small-town college, I decided to go to Syracuse rather than New York, to Columbia. He said, "Well, too bad. If you came to Columbia, you could start on Batman." So I immediately called from the resort to Columbia to see if my application was still good, and fortunately it was. I called Syracuse and told them I was not coming, and I called home and said, "I'm going to New York." I went right from the mountains directly to New York. The only other little thing I added to that story was that I didn't know how to get to New York. I'd never been there before, from the mountains. And it gave me complicated bus connections. But then the manager said, "Well, you know, Jan Pierce, who was one of the greatest tenors at Metropolitan Opera, had given a concert there that weekend. And he was just going back to New York. The manager said, maybe Mr. Pierce might give you a ride in." So I timidly went up to the great man and asked if I possibly get a ride in, and the manager said, you might. He said, oh, sure, kid, hop in. And a big limousine drove up with his chauffeur in the back seat with Jan Pierce. And that's how that was my interest in New York. We got as far as the Bronx, and they kicked me out.
Wow. Well, I want to try to ask you this before we run out of time. It was you and Bill Finger who basically did all the work and toiled in obscurity while Bob Kane made the dough, he got the girls, and pretended to do the work while he was out gallivanting, from all I've heard. At what point did that start to bother you guys?
Well, I guess it always bothered, but it's bothered us, but it seemed to be the tradition that the creator, well, Bob had gone down and signed the contract, unknown to Bill and myself, for Batman. And we just accepted that I was only 17. I was too naive to know anything about artist rights or creator rights. And neither did Bill. Bill was a shoe salesman and trying to break in the writing field with very few connections before. And so we didn't know enough to protect our rights at the time. So we finally, Bill and I decided to leave because we had been getting offers from all the other publishers who wanted anybody who had connection with the success of Batman. And as soon as our publishers heard about it, they immediately contacted us directly and signed a contract with us to work directly with DC and rather than Bob. So then I began to do all the covers of my own stories complete and so forth, as did Bill, where we worked directly for DC rather than Bob. So that's the story in a nutshell.
All right. And then last question, and then we're going to run out of time. Tell me, if you can, in a moment or two, about the creation of the Joker. I can't let you go without asking about that.
Okay. Well, the Joker came about the next year. Batman became so successful, the publisher immediately set a schedule for Batman number one. It had been appearing just once a month in Detective Comics. So they slated Batman number one for the spring, which would contain four new stories. So all of a sudden, Bill and the rest, and from the art standpoint, we had to turn out five stories in the time we normally spend on one. And so Bill was undoubtedly the best writer. He should have been co-creator of Batman. I was there, and I saw he came up with all the mythos of Batman, the backstory, all the other characters, but unfortunately it was not. But he was a very slow craftsman. All the stories were very craftsman and plotted. And so he was confronted with turning out those five stories all at once, which was very difficult. So I immediately volunteered to do one of the stories. Because I was still going to college, I was just splitting my time between Batman and Columbia, and I was down to the raw edge by that time, burning candle at both ends. But they knew that my intent was to be a writer, and I had showed them my stories that I had been writing in my creative writing class. So they were both delighted for me to do a story and relieve Bill of one of the stories out of the four, at least. So I went home that night, and my first thought was, you remember, that period was just coming out of depression. It was the era of the gangster, the bootlegger, the Al Capones, the Pretty Boy Floyd, John Dillinger. Those were the usual pattern for our villains in the comics, except once in a while we'd have a mad scientist, maybe. But there were no superheroes, no supervillains. In fact, the word wasn't even coined at the time. But I knew from my studies that literature and college that all, and before that I was an avid reader, that all great heroes had a protagonist. And, dating from the Bible and David and Goliath to Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty and so forth. So I first thought of coming up for my story first with a villain that was worthy of Batman, worthy to test him. And there was a dichotomy at the time that some thought that if he made the hero rather the villain too strong, it would overpower the hero. and that wouldn't be as good story-wise. Well, I felt just the opposite, and we finally agreed on that. And so I set out to create a villain, and I guess everything in your life fits in somehow. And in my case, a lot of the stories I had written for my classes were satire and the short story form, which was my favorite. I loved De Maupassant and O. Henry and Turgenev and so forth. And so I thought of creating the villain first. And as I had written humor a lot, the next important thing is the name, a proper name for the character that reflects something of his persona. And so I immediately thought of the Joker as a name for my villain. And I knew all villains have good villains have a contradiction in their character. I should have mentioned this first in my reasoning. And so a villain with a sense of humor would be different. And so when I came to that idea, my villain would have some sense of humor about him, some ironic touch. Then I thought of the Joker, and that immediately led to my visualizing the Joker playing card, because the playing cards was a big part of my family. One of my elder brothers was a champion contract bridge player. He won 17 tournaments in the world row. That's where you got master points, like a champion chess players. And so there were always, my mother was a very fine player also. So I was just fair, but I loved the game. And so there was usually a deck of cards around. And I frantically looked that very night for the image of the Joker. And the playing card deck I had that iconic Joker image. And it was a fortunate choice because the Joker goes back in history. It played a part in the medieval life and Shakespearean works. The Joker was an itinerant storyteller. So it had a built-in feeling. And also, the Joker, as a clown, which he is, as a jester, has a cutting edge to it. And many children are afraid of the image of a clown. And even adults, the clown image has a certain edge to it. And those that are really afraid of clowns, there's even a phobia, cultural phobia, is named for that fear of clowns. So the Joker had that kind of edgy quality to begin with, and I think that has a lot to do with the emotion that he arises and his longevity, I think, has to do with that.
Well, it's a shame that we have to end there, but it's wonderful to talk to you. And folks, you can find this terrific new book, Jerry Robinson, Ambassador of Comics, by N.C. Chris Couch, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now online at MrMedia.com.
Well, thanks
price.
For the plug, Bob. Could I
My
add
pleasure.
One more thing? You have time?
Of course.
I am just involved in what a very unusual auction. I don't know if you know. I had saved some of the most iconic pieces of art from the so-called golden age of comics from 39 to 50. And I couldn't bear to see these pieces that I admired so much, done by my colleagues and a few of my own that I wanted to save, from destruction. The publishers routinely, after the art was shot by the engraver, they were routinely torn up and destroyed. And nobody thought of any value of the original art, and nor did I. But I didn't want to see. I couldn't see them destroyed, so I would ask the engraver before they destroyed the cover that I particularly liked to save, to send it back when they made the next pickup. Almost every day they would pick up art that we would do for the next issues, and so I managed to salvage. Some of the most, what's now considered the most historic and iconic art of that time. And now I where we used to pin them on the wall and with that no thought of how valuable they were. I have to keep them in a vault now. But they are now going to go on the next auction by Comic Connect. Comic Connect. And I guess you can see them on their website. And Superman, one of them is Superman 14, which is considered the most iconic Superman cover ever, I think. And it was the height of the war. It was done in 1942 by Fred Ray, who worked right next to me, as did Joe Shuster on the other side, and Jack Kirby was a very good bullpen then. So it's number 14. It's the one with the Superman standing with the shield and the eagle on his shoulder.
I suspected that was it, yeah.
Yeah. And the other one was one of my first Joker covers, number 69, I believe, for the aficionados who know those things. The big Joker, and it's the only time he was shown with guns. This is, I think it's known as the two-gun or the Aladdin cover. Joker is peering out of the Aladdin's lamp holding two guns. It was the only time we showed him with guns. After that, editorial policy was not. But that turned out to be one of the most historic and largest images of the Joker at the time. And that was also done in 1942, so I was just 20 years old at that time. And so those two covers are going up for auction shortly this coming month. And after them for 70, I've protected them for 70 years, but I'm getting to the age where I think they have to go to other hands. And unfortunately,
so,
I have to part with them.
People can find these auction items at comicconnect.com. Is that correct?
That's correct, right.
Okay. And, I'm looking at the site now.
Right.
We'll post the URL, the online address at MrMedia.com.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and then you can see them in the history of them. And I understand already that it's being flooded all over the country. A lot of people are amazed that they were even existent anymore. So they are the oldest existing classic covers. And it was just, as I said in the other story, everything was kind of serendipitous. I just happened to be there those couple of years on staff at D.C. before I moved to found my own studio, that I was there in a position to salvage and save those particular covers. I shudder to think of all those great pieces that were destroyed at the time, and not thinking of artistic value. So now I'm happy to say these pieces are being shown. These have been on tour the last couple of years, by the way, and appeared in museums in Atlanta, where it opened, and Detroit, Cleveland, and Los Angeles just closed. So there is a great appreciation now of them as really an indigenous American art form. And I think you'll be seeing them hang in museums. After all, Lichtenstein and Warhol and Ramos, all those who adapted the comics in their own imagery and that were worth valued at millions of dollars. And here, the images that they took them from are not in the museums where I think they should be protected and appreciated.
All right. Well, folks, so you can check comicconnect.com. These will be auctioned and many more items there. And Jerry Robinson, great to talk to you.
Thanks very much, Bob. It was good to talk to you and your audience.
Stay healthy, and thanks for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Sure, my pleasure.
All right, take care.
Right, ciao.
Bye-bye. And for more original interviews with your favorite comic book and comic strip creators, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Please take advantage of this great offer for Mr. Media radio listeners. Go to audiblepodcast.com/MrMedia to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/MrMedia for your free audiobook. Subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, twitter.com/Andelman, or on Facebook, just search Mr. Media Interviews. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate you giving up a little piece of your day and spending it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Tune in tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel.